Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, joined by Eric Sorensen. Eric, what's going on? People don't know. I've already done this. I've already asked you this. And then we had a technical problem. And so I already know what's going on. It's cold. There's snow. Blah, 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 blah. All that stuff.
Life is uneventful and not worth talking about, not worth sharing. Let's just move on. Yes. No, everything's going fine. You know, my everything's sort of, it's just busy all the time. Everything's busy. You know, I really try hard when I get in conversations with people not to give that answer.
Yeah.
You know, like crazy busy, because, you know, it can easily become like a means by which you're telling people I'm important, I matter, I'm significant. But sometimes I don't know what else to say when it really is super busy, and that's the way it's been lately. I just got back from a retreat. Part of what I do with my work in New York City is I serve as a chaplain with InterVarsity to NYU grad students. And I went on a retreat with them this last weekend, had a great time, got to make a lot of connections with lots of students. Our church plant in the city has quite a few people from NYU that attend and people connected to NYU. So that's kind of what's going on with me. But that meant that I was gone for 4 days in a row. And, you know, anytime you're gone, it's sort of, it makes it difficult to kind of jump right back into life as it is. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think that, yeah, I hate saying that too. Like, oh man, just busy. I mean, it's just, no, there's just no time for anything. It makes you sound like there's things happening and I'm involved in them.
Yes, I matter.
Yeah. So I don't like that. But then I find this too, that most people are busy.
You're not that special.
No, you're not so special. Like, everybody's busy, man. Yeah. That's the world we live in. Most people have got stuff going on.
Everybody's overworked. Everybody's working themselves too much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, between our connections to our smartphones and our devices, we never really know how to, like, we don't really know how to take a break, you know what I mean?
No.
I mean, even on our days off, we can feel mentally exhausted if we're still connected to our devices and connected to our phone because we're getting emails and we're thinking about work. And
have you ever had your kid do this to you? This is a total aside. People don't care about this, but I'm going to say it. Have you ever had one of your kids come up to you and say, I'm bored?
Oh, yeah. And I always tell them the same thing. Have I ever had my kids? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, that happens multiple times a day, Daniel.
Yeah. And I
have three boys, and I always say, oh, that's so good. That means you're going to be a little bit more boredom and you're going to start being creative.
Right. Dude, like, when my daughter comes up to me and is like, I'm bored, I'm like, when I was a kid, and I sound like an old freaking man here. I was a kid, I didn't have all of these outlets to stay my boredom. Like boredom is like my problem. First of all, like, go like go entertain yourself. I don't remember ever in my childhood going to my mom or my dad and being like, I'm bored.
Oh, I did. I remember going to my parents and saying that, and my parents had no sympathy whatsoever.
I just made up stuff to do, and I didn't have game systems and iPads, and I didn't have that stuff, man. I would have never been bored.
You had brothers to wrestle with. That's what you had.
I was busy. I was like, this just sounds like I'm like, oh, get off my lawn. But I mean, I was out in the woods carving a canoe out of a solid piece of wood when I was a kid, man. That's what I was doing. And then figuring out that, like, trying to figure out, why is this so heavy that it won't float? Take out more of the guts. Like, that's, I was like 11 years old doing that stuff. My parents were crazy, by the way. The fact that I was out in the middle of the woods at like 11 with a hatchet for like 8 hours at a time. Like, there's no way I should be alive right now. But,
you know, speaking of get off my lawn and sounding old, I had one of those moments the other day. You know, in case our listeners don't know, I just recently turned 40.
Mm-hmm.
And I can honestly say I truly felt different after I turned, like the day I turned 40. I'm like, wow, this really matters. Well, last week I'm walking in the city and this guy walks up to me out of the blue, this young guy, and he asks me for money. And he says, he refers to me this way. He says, hey, Pops, can I get some money? Pops, get out of here. I'm not that level yet. I'm not there yet, man. But apparently I am, Dan. I don't feel like it, but I reached a new level. I am Pops.
Did I have it on your 40th birthday?
No, it happened like a week after.
Oh man, if that had happened,
isn't that
on, if that had happened on your 40th birthday, that would have been epic. I would have thought that my wife set something up if that happened to me.
Exactly. Yeah. So, all right, we should get to our text. It's much more interesting.
Yeah, 25 minutes in the New Testament now.
Yeah, exactly. So Matthew 26, verse 30 is where we're at, right at the sort of the peak of the Passion narrative when Jesus has just instituted the Lord's Supper. And now we come to verse 30. And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered him, "Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the disciples said the same. Well, I would imagine for our listeners, Dan, that this is a familiar passage that many who have who are familiar with the Bible know this story. Yeah, I never get tired of hearing this because, frankly, Peter reminds me so much of myself. The pride, man, the pride and the arrogance that he has. Here Jesus is like, all right, here's the way it's, remember who I am. I am the Lord. I know all things that have ever taken place and will take place. I am the beginning and the end. And so based on that, here's what I'm going to tell you guys. You're all going to flee. You're going to fall away. Okay. I'm just letting you know, because I am, again, the Lord. And the arrogance of Peter to be like, oh, though they all fall away, I will never fall away.
Yeah, yeah. This is a warning for you. Do not place too much confidence in your devotion to Christ. It's folly. It's folly. Your devotion, your commitment, is much more frail than you think it is. It will break under far less pressure than you think it will.
This is why I have such a problem with preaching that emphasizes our commitment to Jesus, that emphasizes our devotion to Jesus. It's not that if we have faith, we won't have a level of devotion or commitment to Jesus. We will. Faith produces that. That is faith. It's dependence, right? But when it's talked about as a certain level of commitment, and we all know what this means. Like anybody who's sat through Christian sermons for all has heard this kind of thing. It inevitably is going to lead you to failure. Mm-hmm. Because we are just not as steadfast as we should be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is, a lot of things going on here. I mean, like, so Jesus, they've been with him for a while now. And Peter's made like some mistakes, but he also has this great confession about who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. And they're feeling like pretty confident. They're in the upper room, they celebrate the Passover together. And then he's saying like, yeah, you're all going to bail. And Peter, like his arrogance is specifically his arrogance too, because while he could have said something like, we would never do that.
Yeah. He says, Though they all. You just see him pointing at his fellow disciples.
I can't speak for the rest of these guys, but as for me, that will never happen, even if I have to die with you.
Now, it's interesting. I mean, don't you think that at this point, part of what's motivating Peter, I mean, besides his like arrogance and clear thought that he thinks he's even above his other buddies, his other disciples, but don't you think part of what's motivating him to say this is his false perception about what's going to happen with Jesus. Like, he really doesn't believe that Jesus is going to be struck, like Jesus keeps saying to him. He really believes that he's going to be, like, Jesus's right-hand man in the kingdom that he's going to start. Like, he's going to raid Jerusalem, and he's going to kick out Rome, and no, Jesus, you are going to rule, and I'm going to be right next to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's in his mind. And so he's just like, he doesn't have the category for Jesus saying, no, you don't understand. Like, when I die, you're all going to flee.
Yeah, there's this crazy thing where Peter also says, he says to Jesus that he'll die for him. I'll die for you. Which is completely backwards.
Yes, correct.
That you don't die for Jesus, okay?
But here's the thing. I mean, like, this illustrates perfectly. Like, Peter is sort of showing, like, what every person of the flesh, like, what the flesh really wants to be true. Mm-hmm. We're much more comfortable being able to do something, to contribute something to our salvation, even if we have to be the ones that die in order to save ourselves and others. We're much more comfortable with that scenario than we are of Jesus dying for us gratis, like free for us. Because then it takes all skin out of the game.
Right. And I mean, this is what Jesus, part of what Jesus means when he says, where I am going, you cannot follow. I mean, he talks about like, ascending to the Father and preparing a place. But in the context of what he's talking about in that text, which is not in this text, but he does say that. It's in the reference to the cross. You can't go with him there. The reason that this all happens is to illustrate the point that Jesus goes to do the work of salvation alone. You don't participate. You're not involved. That he will go and he will stand trial alone, and he will carry his cross, and he will go and he will die for the sins of the world alone. He does that by himself.
Correct. No one else gets to take an ounce of his glory.
Right.
He gets all of it. Right. Every bit of it for saving sinners.
That's it.
And so, you know, at this point, I mean, you could see a scenario in which Jesus is like, all right, you know, Peter, I'm done with you. You dunce. I'm leaving. I'm going to go pray. But that doesn't happen. Instead, we read in verse 36, then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit here while I go over there and pray. And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, so could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, for the second time, he went away and prayed. My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. There is so much going on here in this passage that I don't know that we'll be able to get much further than right. this passage yeah. before the end of today's podcast. First of all, Gethsemane. It literally means olive press, to the Mount of the Olive Press. So I think it's important as you sort of to set the scene here. What happened in an olive press back in the day, I mean, it literally, you put the olives in this large sort of circular stone tablet. And then to get olive juice or olive oil, not olive juice, olive oil, they would put this large sort of stone over the olives. They'd lay olives all over this tablet, and then they'd crush them. And the oil that would come out would seep through, and they would collect it in jars or baskets or whatnot. So the picture that we need to have in mind when we think about the place called Gethsemane is a place of tremendous pressure coming down, tremendous pressure that's causing the oil, if you were, to be squeezed out. That's the idea of what's happening here in Gethsemane.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's sort of what you see play out with Jesus in this section.
Yeah, I think there's something awesome about the humanity of Jesus in this moment too, where you get to see, you see all kinds of instances about Jesus being God. I sometimes think that people try to comfort people with the divinity of Christ, where, you know, like, well, God knows, because, you know, he's God. God understands, because he's God. But the truth is that a lot of the stuff that we suffer and we go through, and the fear that we feel, and the anguish that we feel, and even the sorrow, I mean, it says that he is very sorrowful, that God doesn't just know because he's God. He knows because he's man. There's a real comfort in God being man. Because it's one thing to have, they say that an all-knowing, all-powerful being understands. It's right. Like, I mean, you would call it into question, because you're like, does he? He doesn't know what it's like to not be an all-powerful, finite creature. And so, like, I don't think there's a ton of comfort there. But when you say, like, look, man, Jesus knows what it's like to be afraid, to have fear, to have dread, to have sorrow, to suffer. These are all things that he experiences in his humanity. And so there is some comfort there when you read this. And this is, you know, traumatic language. My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. And he goes and prays, and he doesn't, if it's possible, let this cup pass. Jesus is not, you know, he sets his face like a flint to Jerusalem to go do this, and he's resolved to do it. But at the moment when he knows it's like, all right, it's time to go, it's not as though he's like, all right, let's do it.
No, no. As a matter of fact, I find this to be actually sort of an apologetic for the truthfulness of the account. Because it, especially in that world at that time, in the Roman world, heroes are never presented like this. Heroes are never presented as weak and waffling and struggling and doubting. I mean, if you read, you know, for example, the Maccabean accounts of what happened, there's this deep sort of revolt against the threat of death, and they're willing to go through the cutting off of leg and limb, and they don't care because they're so committed to the cause. And this is really like kind of the archetype of like the Roman sort of hero, somebody who doesn't care about pain. It's honorable to suffer. And here Jesus is thinking about what's coming, and he can't keep on his feet. He's falling to his knees on his face and praying. It's not the kind of picture that you'd want to have of your Lord if you're trying to, quote, sell a religion in that part of the world, right, the empire. Why is it in there? Because it's true. Because it actually happened. And the way Luke describes it is a little bit more vivid. Luke describes Jesus as being so incredibly stressed out that he sweats drops of blood. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that that can happen. We do know that it can happen, but only under extreme duress, extreme right. amounts of stress. So again, the olive press here is coming down on Jesus. It is crushing him, and it is driving him to his knees to pray. You know, there's a great scene in the movie The Passion of the Christ. It actually opens in the Garden of Gethsemane, and the way that Mel Gibson, the director, chooses to sort of portray this moment is, as Jesus is praying, the devil is right there next to him, whispering in his ear, "You can't pay for the sins of the whole world. If your father really loved you, where is he now?" He's calling into question all of the reasons for why Jesus is doing what he's doing, and he's really struggling. And then at the end of the account in the film, those who've seen it will remember this, he gets up and symbolically crushes the snake that Satan has let out to sort of slither in between him and tempt him. And so there's this great picture of Jesus in this garden, the Garden of Gethsemane, undoing what was done in the Garden of Eden.
Right. Yeah.
He's crushing the head of the serpent. Yeah, God, as was promised in Genesis 3.
Yeah, God does a lot of stuff in the garden. You have the fall in the garden. You have this instance where the devil seems to be trying to call into question, perhaps the faithfulness of God, the word of God. And then you also have in the resurrection account, where that happens in a garden as well, where in the first garden, the word of God says that there's a curse and that the wages of sin is death and this sort of thing, that in a garden it is announced also to a woman, by the way, that all that has been reversed and defeated.
Yeah, the woman is the first, well, for lack of a better term, professor of the resurrection.
That's right. That's right.
She's the first one to profess the truth of the resurrection.
It's true.
Just
saying.
It's important to know that. Yeah. All right. But here's the other part of this account here. This saying, you also have the disciples. So like literally right after, Peter's like, "Oh, I will die for you. I will do it all.
I will die for you, but I can't stay awake with you. But you better believe when push comes to shove, I will die. Wake me up when it's time to die."
Yeah. I want to talk smack against Peter, but like, I'm just like, you know what it is? Peter's just like a guy who's so in the moment. I have to believe this. That like in the moment, he's like, "I will die." But then the reality hits like an hour later. He's like, "Oh, I'm tired. Man, I'm really tired. I could just go take a little nap." I'm like, dude, that's so me. This is like, this is who I am. Like, I'm so committed one moment to something, and the next moment it's just fleeting and gone, and I'm ready for night. I mean, oh, it's so pathetic, the picture. He has to come back three times.
Yeah. And they're sleeping. I remember there's a guy one time was talking about how, you know, if you can't pray for an hour in the morning, you know, there's something wrong with you. Ugh. And I was thinking, really? Because the disciples had, like, Jesus in the flesh being like, "Come pray with me," and they couldn't seem to hack it. Like, I mean, it seems pretty human that's the case. I mean, literally, God in the flesh saying, "Hey, pray," and then they can't, and then him coming back and saying, "Pray," and they can't. I mean, so the idea that that we're totally different than this or something is absurd. We have the same thing. I remember going to prayer meetings. We had these really long prayer meetings when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. And they would last like, there'd be like an hour where everyone's just praying silently. And they'd turn the lights all low.
Oh, dude. Sure you're going night-night.
So, it's on like a Wednesday night. Lights go down low and they put on like this soft worship music.
Oh, and then little Jesus people music from the 70s, Maranatha music.
Yeah, dude. And so there I would be on my knees.
Lights out, man.
And I just bury my face in like a seat, you know, like in one of the chairs. And then the next thing I know, I'm hearing someone say, "All right, guys, let's all gather up front." And my head pops up. And I got drool running down my side of my face. I got the imprint of the chair cushion on my face. I'm wondering if I was snoring.
So what you're saying is there's not a whole lot that's changed in 2,000 years about God's people.
It's true.
Yeah, this is true. I've been there, man. I've been there. Very similar scenario. But so let's move on. Let's try and get through the betrayal and arrest of Jesus. And so while he was still speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a great crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him." And he came up to Jesus at once and said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and he kissed him. Jesus said to him, "Friend, do what you came to do." Then they came up and laid hands on Jesus and seized him. And behold, one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. Then Jesus said to him, put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should the scriptures be fulfilled, that it must be so? At that hour, Jesus said to the crowds, have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I sat in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But all this has taken place, that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples left him and fled.
There it was. That didn't take long for that to come to pass, did it?
No. It's interesting. You know, we learn from the other gospel accounts that Peter is the one who does stand up to stab this guy or to fight against this guard, and ends up cutting off the ear of the servant of the high priest. And so initially Peter, you know, he seems, this is like, I'm going to make good on my deal. I mean, I'm going to, even if I have to die for you, like, I'm going to fight. But in Jesus's healing of the servant of the high priest, maybe it's the case that Peter sees that after he's risked life to fight for Jesus and Jesus ends up healing this guy. Maybe at that moment, Peter goes, I don't know if I can stick around for this.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that's what we were here to do. To fight these guys, to take them out. Oh, that's not what we're here to do. Well, count me out then.
You know, I think that this whole thing really shows the disciples like what's going on. I mean, when Judas shows up, and one, like, betrayed with a kiss is rough.
Yeah, it's brutal.
And what's interesting about this is that when Judas comes up to him and kiss, it says greetings, Rabbi, and kissed him. It is interesting that Jesus says friend. Like that's a tender word from Christ. I mean, to say friend, do what you came to do. I don't think he's being sarcastic.
No.
Or anything like that. Like, I think this is rough. And I think that this is one of the things that probably like strikes Judas to the point where he ends up regretting very much what he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, it is a striking thing that Matthew remembers that. The way Jesus addresses him is with that word,
mm-hmm.
friend.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and then you have, so that's got to be probably disconcerting to Peter and the disciples. He's like not, you know, he's not saying, what the heck, man?
Yeah,
Judas back. Judas walks up and he's like, oh, see? Like, what a punk. He doesn't do that. Peter tries to, he puts a sword. And this is definitely the kind of thing where, This is not how the kingdom of God works, man. It's not how it works.
The kingdom of God always works by its opposites. I mean, you know, the whole passion narrative is one big study in the theology of the cross and how God always works in ways that are hidden to us. We think by pulling out our swords and by fighting the bad guys that that's the way the kingdom will advance. What does the kingdom advance by? It advances by a cross. In every way, by the way, we can always go back to the cross. Like you look to answer the question, like, well, how do I know God loves me? Well, we can say, like, you could take the answer, like, well, his word says it. But if you want tangible expression of it, go to the cross. Everything ends up at the cross. Everything goes to the cross. The cross is our faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, and it's all part of the plan. I mean, it, like at the very end here, I love the fact that Jesus is like, listen, if I wanted to call 12 legions of angels to destroy you, I could. But this is happening because the scriptures said it's going to happen this way.
Now, this is why Jesus is the kind of Lord you want.
Right.
Because you want a Lord that will sacrifice for you, that has your best in his mind at all times. That's gentle and kind and loving, but you don't want one that's weak,
right? Yeah, he can destroy him in a second.
The greatest example of strength is a guy with restrained power, That's what Jesus is. Jesus is the kind of guy that could call down legions of angels. He's the kind of guy that can walk up on dead people and just decide that he doesn't want them to be dead anymore. I don't know if you know, but that's extreme power. Just, hey, I don't feel like you're not dead anymore because I said so. That's quite a bit of power. He's a guy that when he comes in contact with pure evil in the form of demonic powers, that they are terrified of him. But he is also the kind of guy who lays down his life. You can't take it. He makes it very clear. You cannot take my life from me. I freely give it. He's the ultimate Lord. He's the God you want. Powerful, able to fight off evil. Evil and darkness fear him, but is gentle and kind and is after your redemption.
And that is good news. In spite of leaving off on a sour note about the disciples leaving him and fleeing, the good news is that Jesus will never leave us nor flee from us, never leave us nor forsake us. And we'll continue to see how that manifests itself as we continue the story in the Passion narrative as next time we talk about his trial.
Yeah, in the crazy turn of events, Jesus never forsakes us by going off and doing this alone.
Mm-hmm. That's how it works. Right.
All right, that's it. We are out of time. Guys, go over to CHF, thechristholdfast.org. Look at the events and come hang out with us in North Dakota, May 19th. We're going to be talking about the Psalms. We want to see you there. It's going to be a blast. If you live anywhere near there, come hang out. Eric, we are out of time. We'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.